This is Central Time. Language is a work in progress. Just today, the Oxford English Dictionary named its word of the year one that's increased in usage by 17,000% since 2012. Here's a hint, you probably posted one in the last year. We'll fill you in about that later.
Now we'll dive into some of the coolest words in the English language that didn't make the cut, that got lost in the shuffle over the years and fell out of use.
Mark Forsyth joins us now. He writes the Inky Fool blog about language, and he's the author of the new book, Horologicon, A Day's Jaunt Through the Lost Words of the English Language. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, you've written a book drawing our attention to a bunch of gorgeous, funny, often pretty useful words. So why have they more or less gone extinct?
Well, it's an odd question. One of the most beautiful words, just to say, beautiful words off the tongue in the English language is snollygoster, which is actually an American word. So it was invented in the 19th century and had a pretty good career. And a snollygoster means a dishonest politician. And I've no idea why on earth that died out. My only possible conclusion is that all politicians in America are now honest, and so it ceased to have any useful meaning.
That's pretty much right, yeah.
If only we could catch up with you.
Yeah. The title itself, the title of your book is Horologicon, which is a great word in itself. It means, I know from your book, a book of hours. And so how did you use that book of hours as the format for your book?
Well, the thing about most dictionaries, I mean, everyone's looked at dictionary and everyone has said to themselves, you know, wow, that's a great word occasionally. But when you go back and try and find that word, you can't find it because dictionaries are arranged A to Z, which is a terrible problem, really, because you go off, you say, there must be a word for what I'm thinking of. And you settle down to read the whole of the Oxford English Dictionary or whatever it happens to be. And a guy actually did this a few years ago. He read all 18 volumes of the complete Oxford English Dictionary. It took him a year to do that. But if you tried that when you were in the middle of a conversation, you'd probably come back and find that the conversation moved on. So I wanted to write a book and arrange the words by the time of the day that they might come in useful. So anti-gentacular, which is a beautiful old word meaning before breakfast, best way to describe a Bloody Mary, or utkiara, which is an old English word which means anxiety experience, sorrow experience just before dawn. It's a wonderful word. If you've ever woken up and not been able to, before dawn, much too early, not been able to get back to sleep because you're worried about the day to come, that's utkiara. There was a word for that. And it's beautiful to know that even 1,000 years ago, people had a word for that emotion.
It's beautiful, and it's also kind of comforting, isn't it? You think, oh, there's even a word for that, so I must not be alone.
Yeah, you're not alone. You're not alone. For at least 1,000 years, people have been feeling exactly the same way.
Well, there's a word that's beautiful, another one that sounds beautiful on the tongue that you write about. It's Italian. It's sprezzatura, for pretending to be nonchalant, which I think has a lot of applications in our society today. Tell us about that one.
Sprezzatura is a beautiful word. It's a beautiful word for a beautiful thing. It's beautiful to say, first of all, which is the most important thing about a word, really. But achieving an awful lot whilst appearing to not do anything. And back in the Renaissance, there were all sorts of books about how you should behave, how you should live your life. And one of the most important things in these books, the big one was by a guy called Castiglione, and saying that you should never be seen to make an effort. You should be really good at stuff, but you should never actually look like you really tried at it. So you should be a great piano player. I mean, piano wasn't invented, but that sort of thing. You should be a great piano player, but you should never be heard to practice. You should just say, oh, really, the piano? Let me have a go at that. Oh, my God, it turns out I'm really, really damn good. And I love that word. It's a great word. It describes a great thing. But unfortunately, the modern world is completely against sprezzatura. We're all into the notion of FaceTime, of turning up in the office and making sure that everyone can see that we're there, and making sure we're seen to be making an effort, even if we're not achieving anything.
I could see a teenage rock band operating in a sprezzatura kind of way, like, oh yeah, we rock, but you know, we want to make it look like we're putting effort into it. So I could see a place for it in the modern world.
I've always wanted company reports to be written like that. You know, usually whenever you know a deal is done in mergers and acquisitions, it says, you know, this down to an awful lot of hard work on the part of these people. I would love it if just occasionally company issued a press release saying, we never really tried at this. We just, you know.
We're so naturally good. It just sort of happened.
Yeah.
Sprezzatura.
Yeah, that's the way things happen around here.
So that was a word that was actually used in the English language. It wasn't just an Italian thing?
It was used in the English language like that because, it was originally an Italian word. You're quite right. But Castiglione, who wrote this book, The Book of the Courtier, The Book of the Perfect Courtier, that became the standard work for how a gentleman should behave for several hundred years after he wrote it. And so there was no translation for Sprezzatura. So in a lot of the versions that came out all around Europe, they just stuck with that old word, that old Italian word. I mean, usually there is an English word for these things, but just very occasionally there isn't. There's a beautiful Soviet Russian word, Sturmovshchina, which means working really, really hard just before a deadline, having done nothing for the previous
time. Wait, I think we need to learn that word on the show.
Yeah.
I still have trouble spelling it, but it's a beautiful word, Stomoschina.
Stomoschina.
It comes out of Soviet Russia when you used to sit around at the factory for a month waiting for the actual raw materials to arrive so that you could actually, you know, make whatever it is that you were meant to be making. And then, you know, 48 hours before, you'd realize they're not arriving. But if I don't make this stuff, then I'm going to the gulag. So then you went into a shtomoshchina and absolutely went crazy to just try and fulfill the production targets for a month in 24 hours or 48 hours or whatever it happened to be.
We're talking to Mark Forsyth about lost words of the English language. We're having a great conversation, but we're not really trying very hard at it. Sprezzatura. His book is Horologicon.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We'll continue our conversation now, exploring words that didn't stand the test of time but are fun to remember and useful. We're talking to Mark Forsyth, author of Horologicon. Let's get to another one of these fun words. Oh, where's that one that I picked out and thought was really fun? Let's do, how about just water? I think that one applies to me pretty often.
Water, did you say?
Zwodder, Z-W-O-D-D-E-R.
Oh, water. Zwodder is a beautiful old word meaning a sort of drowsy, dreamy state. When you're half awake and half asleep, you're in a zwodder. It just fits. It fits with the way you feel and the way you pronounce things when you're in that sort of state as the water.
Yeah, the word is almost like that onomatopoeia. Like it's the sound you would make when you're in that condition.
Exactly, yeah. There's a beautiful and another beautiful word for being lazy, for doing nothing, which surprised the hell of me. But it sort of made sense very quickly. Gongoozle.
Gongoozle
is a word, and I found this, I just came across this in the Oxford English Dictionary, because I'm a very, as you probably worked out, I'm a very lonely, boring man who reads dictionaries for fun, and I found the word gongoozle. And gongoozle means to stare idly at a canal or other watercourse and do nothing.
I like that they specify canal and then move on to other watercourse.
Yeah.
It's delightfully specific.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I thought to myself, I can't believe that word exists. It's too strange. It's too weird.
I don't know if we can ever actually use it, but...
I have gongoozled at rivers before.
All right.
Definitely.
So have I. This is what I suddenly realized. Next time I was down near a canal or any other watercourse, there's always people, always on the beach. There are people just staring out to sea. By a river, there are always people sitting there just looking at the river, or just looking at the canal, looking at the lake, and they're all gongoozling. And I have this amazing feeling when I pass them. I'm thinking, you're all gongoozlers. And I know you're good. And I'm the only person who knows that.
Not anymore. Well, yeah. I want to talk about some of the words that revolve around eating, because there are some particularly useful ones, it seems, in there. You know, eating sort of has a lot of fad words that pass through. And one that sounds nice to the ear, sort of onomatopoeic again, is the word bristled.
Yeah, bristled. A beautiful word. So sometimes the word just tells you what it means almost in the sound. It's a wonderful thing. And it's the same with bristled for food, or with filogrobolized, which means hungover in the morning. Filogrobolized couldn't mean anything other than hungover, but it's a beautiful way of saying it. And it's a beautiful excuse if you ever need to talk to your boss and say, you know, what's wrong with you? I'm filogrobolized. Sometimes these words just have that this power which leaps out from the sound, from the onomatopoeia.
Here's another good food one that I liked, and I've done this too, to pingle. How does one pingle?
To pingle is to push food around your plate without actually eating it. Very, very useful term, and something which everybody does now and again. And it's the opposite of guttling. To guttle is to eat your food very, very greedily. And if you guttle too much, you'll become a Gundy Guts, which is a beautiful 18th century word for a very, very fat person.
A Gundy Gut?
A Gundy Guts, yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
And
you
amazingly,
went to...
all these words, I mean, I made a point when I was collecting these words that they're still useful. People still understand what they mean in a strange sort of way, as long as you use them in context. They sound right. If you say to somebody, you're a Gundy Guts, they'll know exactly what you mean. There's a word which I found in a very obscure little dialect dictionary from the 19th century. The verb is to poon. And poon means to put a little thing under the leg of a table to stop the table rocking. And that's something which is very, very common. And I've used it ever since. And every time I say to a waiter at a restaurant, excuse me, I think you need to poon the table, they go straight off and they come back with a little wedge of paper to put under the leg of the table.
I thought they're going to come back with a manager.
That's where I thought that was going to. Yeah.
Well, we'd call that shimming. I shim things here. Maybe it's over here in the colonies.
You've
we do
got a
that.
Word
yeah.
for it. Wow, that's
yeah.
brilliant.
Yeah, we discovered that word earlier this year, shimming. We had to do it at a table. Yeah, those are very useful words for, you know, things that happen every day in our lives. And I wonder if there are other words like that that you think, you know, this word is just too good to language in the dusty closet of English, and it should be out in the sun again. What word would you bring back if you could?
My favorite word, just because it's my favorite word to say aloud in the English language, is wamblecropped. And actually, that had its last stand in America. Once upon a time, your stomach could be wambling. You could have a touch of the wambles. But if you were really completely overcome with indigestion, then you were wamblecropped. And you go, oh, God, I can't do anything. I'm sorry, I'm wamblecropped.
Well, that's a good one. Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining us. There's so much to go on there. Thank you so much for sharing all these words.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
That was Mark Forsyth. He writes the Inky Fool blog about language, and he's the author of the new book we've been talking about with a lot of words that we didn't get to, Horologicon, A Day's Jaunt Through the Lost Words of the English Language.
And now it's time to give a shout-out to the new word of the year as decreed by the editors of Oxford Dictionaries.
All right, here it is. The new word of the year, selfie. Selfie. Its usage is up to 17,000% since last year, which I guess means we're getting really narcissistic. So the definition, Veronica, if you please.
Right. So it brings us to the definition. A selfie, if you don't know, is a picture you take of yourself, usually with your phone or your device of some sort. And there are some folks around the office who I guess we will not name by name who say selfies are explicitly for dating websites, and that's why you wanted to put them out there. Other people take selfies when they're driving, which seems, I think we can all agree, like a really bad idea. Or maybe you're at a special place. You're at a concert. You're having a good hair day. And we'd love to know what your reason is for taking that selfie.
If you have a selfie of yourself, or you can take one right now, decent and appropriate, post your selfie or your irritation with the word selfie on the Central Time Facebook page. Looking forward to seeing some of those.
And curious if you have another nomination for Word of the Year. We'd be curious about what that would be, too. Selfie has definitely climbed in popularity. And I guess I've taken a selfie. Have you taken selfies?
I have never. So I picture that. I know I only have somebody else take the picture of me. Or if we're doing a family portrait, my wife will hold the phone out. My arms are longer so I can get a better picture, but I'm inept with cameras. So I drop them or the phone. And so, yeah, no, I'm not a good selfie candidate for myself or for the family as a whole.
Well, you've been in a selfie, though.
Well, Is it a selfie if I didn't take it myself? That's a deeper philosophical
issue.
That's
deep, Rob. Yeah. We're going to have to devote half an hour to that next week, I think. Right. So let us know about your selfies, and we'll be curious to hear and share what you have done so far with your selfie.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the show, it's tempting to think of dolphins like the friendly, tail-wagging dogs of the ocean. But our guest says that stories about special human-dolphin relationships are probably overblown. We'll find out why.
First, when we talk about the Wisconsin economy, it's easy to take a one-size-fits-all approach. Either we're doing well or we're not, right? Well, our next guest says the answer isn't so clear-cut.
In a new report that covers 13 years of data crunched by the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, Wisconsin's divided into six distinct economic regions, each with different economic profiles.
Joining us now is Todd Berry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Todd, welcome to Central Time.
Well, good to be back.
So, Todd, tell us about this. Why break Wisconsin down into six separate economic regions?
Well, we've been sort of amused the last couple of years as politicians on both sides of the aisle have been pulling monthly economic data, job statistics, often that were revised to mean something entirely different, and they were always focused on statewide numbers, and we thought it was important to take a longer view, so we go back to 2000, and to look at the state in pieces rather than as a whole. And it's quite striking when you do that, because what you find is that some regions are outperforming the state and are doing well compared to the nation, and others are lagging the state and losing ground.
So when we say something like jobs are up or jobs are down in Wisconsin, it doesn't tell the whole story. Where are we seeing the state doing well? What kind of regions?
Well, the two that are leading the pack are western Wisconsin, so the counties along the river running from, you know, Grant in the south all the way up to Polk in the north. And then the other region, which is actually the fastest growing one, are the counties that are, including Dane and surrounding Dane.
So that, I gather, is not a surprise. You've got the capital, a major research university. That one is a kind of a self-driving force, right?
Yeah, you'd expect the Madison area to do all right, because this includes two recessions, and of course, state government and the university are going to be a little less volatile during a recession than some industries. But what's interesting is that it's particularly the information technology sector that really stands out in terms of employment growth there. So it's about a lot more than just, you know, the things that we traditionally think of the Madison area as representing.
And western Wisconsin, I gather, was more of a surprise to economists.
Yeah, it was. And it's not that every county out there is doing spectacularly, but over the whole region, it looks pretty good. We've known for some time that St. Croix, Pierce counties, the counties that are commuter counties to the Twin Cities, had been doing rather well. But when you look at some of the other counties up and down the river, in terms of employment growth, it was second only to the greater Madison area, and its earnings and its incomes were growing faster than the state as a whole.
Now, on the downside, we have kind of opposite ends of the spectrum. Let's start in southeastern Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, I guess we'd call it the post-industrial part of the state.
Yeah. I mean, we're running from Walworth and Kenosha in the south to Sheboygan in the north, and as far west as Jefferson County. Mm. And, yeah, this is where 40% of the jobs in the state are. It's historically had the highest average incomes, and yet it had the largest job losses, and in terms of earnings and income, at best it was keeping pace with the state, which was trailing the nation.
And that includes the suburban belt around Milwaukee.
That includes the suburban belt around Milwaukee. So, it truly is, you know, that urban southeast, which includes a significant part of the population, jobs, and historically wealth.
And also in decline, northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, and of course, this isn't as much of a surprise. You know, for instance, school enrollments have been dropping throughout large parts of the north for many years, and it actually lost population. And its job loss was almost as large as southeast Wisconsin. What was a little bit of a surprise to us was that in areas such as lodging and hospitality, the job losses were fairly noticeable, and you wouldn't expect that for this part of the state that we like to vacation in.
So in the middle of the pack, we had the Green Bay, Fox Cities was in a region, and then mm-hmm. Wausau and central Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Anything notable that struck you in either of those?
Well, the Fox Valley northeast area is on the margin, doing a little better than the state. It had job growth over the last 13 years, while the state had slight job decline. It had more population growth than the state as a whole, and its manufacturing sector, which is an important one in Wisconsin since we're one of the leading manufacturing states, it probably held up better than in some other regions of the state. So the Fox Valley Northeast is, and we call it sort of the happy medium. Central Wisconsin is performing about on par with the rest of the state, so it too is sort of middle of the pack, but it's certainly not setting the world on fire.
So what are the lessons here now? We've got these six regions mm-hmm. pulling in their own directions. If you're a state policymaker, what do you learn from this to try to boost the state overall and these regions in particular?
Well, I think before you pursue policy solutions, first of all, you've got to be watching the right things and asking the right questions. And lesson one is look at data over multiple economic cycles and data that are good and reliable and final, rather preliminary and speculative and last month's subject to change. And the other is that there isn't such a thing as a Wisconsin economy, and so why do we focus on that in all our debate? And different areas of the state have different strengths. I mean, one of the messages of the South Central region is they lost a lot of manufacturing jobs, but they still outpaced the state. So there's an example to steal a phrase, creative destruction, where you're losing on the one hand, but you're more than making up for it on the other. And I think the lesson from the western part of the state is its growth is very broad-based. It's a diverse economy. There's some strength in dairy. There's some strength in mining. There's strength in healthcare, education. And that area held up better in terms of manufacturing than any other part of the state. So it was very much a diverse economy.
Todd, you mentioned at the outset, basically both sides in state government are waving dueling job reports mm-hmm. at each other and just trying to make political hay out of them a lot of the time. Do you think that's going to change that, and that both sides might hunker down and try to get into the details and see what works?
Short answer is no. it's been going on for a couple years, and we were just hoping that, you know, perhaps after the political season, people will have come to realize that they need to think long haul, and they need to think regionally, and one size does not fit all.
All right, Todd, thanks a lot for being with us today.
My pleasure.
That's Todd Berry. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance.
Lots of us are fascinated with dolphins, and there have been stories and legends of dolphins saving drowning humans for centuries that have helped increase that fascination.
But is there a special relationship between humans and dolphins? The author of a new book joins us now to tackle that question. Justin Gregg is a research associate with the Dolphin Communication Project. His new book is Are Dolphins Really Smart? And we've linked his recent article on the Central Time Facebook page. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
So first, what kind of beliefs are out there, true or not, about this idea of a dolphin-human bond?
Yeah, well, there's sort of a general belief that dolphins are extremely friendly and peaceful animals that have a long reputation, as you noted in the intro, of saving humans, rescuing them from shark attacks or if they're drowning, and that this finds its way into the sort of tourist industries based on swimming with dolphins.
There's a whole lot of stories like that out there, though. I mean, okay, I'll be upfront with you here. I love dolphins. I paid for the, you know, meet a dolphin thing at SeaWorld. I thought it was incredible. And, you know, this is sort of hard to hear. So how do you discount some of these stories? You know, one Rob and I were talking over in the office was Elian Gonzalez, who says that he was saved by dolphins.
Yeah, that's definitely a famous case. Oh, I don't discount them at all. In fact, there's a lot of great evidence in the scientific literature showing that the dolphins go out of their way to interact with human beings. They're these animals that fall in the category of lone sociable dolphins. These are dolphins that are sort of off by themselves, not spending too much time with other dolphins, and coming to the beaches and to the harbors just to interact with humans. But when it comes to those rescue stories, of course, you know, I also agree that they probably happen. Dolphins have a reputation with themselves for rescuing each other and helping each other. But the problem as a scientist is you always want to see the video. You want to see the data to confirm it. Otherwise, you have to sort of take it with a grain of salt. So I'm sure it happens, but I wish there were more data that we could look at to confirm exactly how it happens.
Well, are dolphins in the wild generally or always friendly to humans?
No, that's definitely not the case. There are actually 40-odd species of dolphins, and there are species like Cummerson's dolphins and Fraser's dolphins, which no one has really ever heard of because they rarely interact with humans at all. They live far out to sea. And then you have bottlenose dolphins, which live near where humans live on the coasts, and they interact with humans in a variety of different ways. Sometimes they're very friendly, like those lone sociable dolphins, but then sometimes these interactions are not always friendly. They have been known to attack and to bite people. So it's sort of a mixed bag of friendly and unfriendly behavior.
It seems like there are a handful of these swim with dolphin encounter programs around the world that obviously do pretty well for tourist sites. And it sounds like with these populations of dolphins, you know, you've got different categories, and some of them, the dolphins are acclimated to people first and deliberately so that they can be used in this way. And maybe in one or two cases, the dolphins themselves did prove friendly. So how do you sort out, you know, what's going on there?
Yeah, there are so many different situations that have sort of cropped up organically. Like you said, some dolphins have sought out the company of humans. Like in the Bahamas, you can swim with wild dolphin groups that seem quite interested in not all the time, but sometimes, in swimming with humans. And then in other cases, you have humans that have targeted dolphins and fed them food to try and get them interested in interacting with people. And everything else in between. You have dolphins swims out in Hawaii, for example, with spinner dolphins who are sometimes interested and sometimes not. And then, of course, you have dolphin swim programs in captivity, but that's it's hard to judge, of course, because they're not free to choose their own interactions. But in the wild, you have all sorts of different kinds of interactions that occur.
So do you think that the belief that there's a special bond between humans and dolphins leads us to want to interact with dolphins in ways that are not good for the dolphins?
Yeah, that is one of the problems. I mean, there's good evidence to show that humans and dolphins do enjoy each other's company, but the sort of overarching belief that they really want to be with us can lead to some problems, of course. Humans will, you know, with these industries based on tourism, they'll go out with all these boats and try and swim with the dolphins, and that can be very disturbing for the dolphins, obviously. So that's not always a good thing. You have to be very careful with these tourist industries. But then also people will feed dolphins to try and get them to come closer to the boats so that they can pet them. And that's obviously a very bad thing for the dolphins. And a lot of dolphins that end up getting too close to humans in a general way, whether or not they're being fed or just hanging out near boats, end up injured or killed, sometimes by accident and sometimes on purpose. So it's just in a general way, better for dolphins to sort of stay out doing their dolphin things and humans to do their human thing and not spend too much time together.
And you talked about the dolphins who are injured and killed. There were also some pretty surprising stories in your piece about humans getting injured. Now, there's only one incidence of a guy who got killed after his encounter with a dolphin. But just so we see the other side of this, can you tell a couple stories about some bad things that happened to people who interacted with dolphins?
Yeah, well, in generally, it's extremely rare to be injured by a dolphin at all. It almost never happens in all these encounters. But with those lone sociable dolphins that I was talking about before, those are the ones that they're kind of weird dolphins to begin with because they don't want to spend time with the dolphins. They want to spend time with people. And in a lot of those cases, and in fact, the majority of those cases, although they're social and interested in people, they do end up injuring people a lot of the time. Sometimes they'll drag them out to sea or pin them to the seafloor. Or bite them or ram them, breaking ribs and causing injuries. And there's a famous story of the only incident of a dolphin killing a human being in the wild was one of these lone sociable dolphins in Brazil, and a couple of guys who were apparently intoxicated were trying to restrain the dolphin and maybe even trying to shove a cigarette into the blowhole of the dolphin, which, as you can imagine, the dolphin did not enjoy at all and actually killed one of these swimmers.
So I think part of the fascination with dolphins, we always hear or often hear dolphins are the smartest thing out there or one of the smartest non-human animals in the world. Are they that intelligent? Are they one of our smartest peers on the planet?
Yeah, that's in my book, that's really what I'm investigating, this idea that they are one of the smartest or the second smartest or almost as smart as human beings. And, of course, as a scientist, you say, well, you can't really rank animals that way. It's not really fair to create this scale of who's the smartest, with humans, of course, always being in the top. But you can look at all the things that dolphins do to see if they do behaviors that are complicated in the way that human behavior is complicated. And you find, yeah, actually, when it comes to social cognition, the complexity of their social societies, and some of the lab work they do with symbol comprehension, they're right up there with the great apes and sometimes different crow species in terms of complex things that they can do. But of course, we hear a lot of other things that they're supposedly really good at, which when you look at the science isn't always the case.
Like what?
Well, people often say that dolphins have a communication system that's more complicated than other animals, that is a lot like human language. And when you sort of look at the way it works, yeah, it's definitely complicated, but it's probably not correct to consider it as complicated as human language. So that's often something you hear, which is a little bit overblown.
There's been a lot of attention lately on killer whales in captivity. The documentary Blackfish shined a light on that and has people wondering whether it's kind of ridiculous to have orcas in captivity because they can become neurotic and can kill people. Now, an orca is a lot bigger than a dolphin, but you're talking about another extremely intelligent form of marine life that is often used in sort of marine amusement parks. Is there a case like that to be made for dolphins in captivity, or do you think there's nothing wrong with that?
Well, the killer whales are actually dolphins. They're actually the largest of all dolphin species. You have to look at every different species and how it reacts or would react to different kinds of captivity. Every species is different. Some can handle being sort of isolated and away from groups, and other species, like, for example, meerkats, it would be really terrible to take a meerkat away and put it all by itself because they live in these complicated groups and they thrive in contact with each other. So when it comes to dolphins as well, you have to look to see whether or not you can replicate in captivity what they have in the wild and how that might impact their welfare and their well-being.
So, Justin, you've demystified some of the things that might fascinate people about dolphins, but you've devoted your career to studying them. What fascinates you about dolphins?
Exactly the same things that fascinate everyone else. I was really interested in dolphin communication system because I thought, wow, it might be a lot like language. So I spent my whole career sort of investigating to see how it worked. And this is often the way when you ask a simple question like, are dolphins intelligent or do they have a language, and you dedicate years of your life, you end up with all these murky details, and things aren't always as black and white as you think when they start out. So I still have the same fascination with dolphins that I've always had. It's just now I have all these extra details in my head about what kind of animals dolphins are, and it's not the same as when I started.
Have you ever had a dolphin encounter, you know, in our last minute here that made you scratch your head and think maybe there is something special there?
Yeah, well, pretty much any time I've swum in the water with dolphins, it's like that. I mean, as a scientist, you try and remain calm and collected so you can analyze the data and observe the behavior. But pretty much every time I jump in the water to film dolphins, you always get this sort of tingly feeling because it's just really cool to be in the water with them because they're interested in you and they're looking at you, and it's a different experience than swimming with fish, for example.
All right, Justin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was dolphin researcher Justin Gregg. We've got an article he wrote linked on the Central Time Facebook page, and his new book is titled, Are Dolphins Really Smart?